Hey guys, this week's sponsor is Automation Finance, and it's open to both accredited and non-accredited investors. We'll tell you more about them during the break.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey bosses, this is Johnny and welcome to episode 138 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I'm still out here in Welligama, Sri Lanka, and Sam is in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show, Johnny. It's a wild world out there. I hope we are both in a place of relative peace and health. I assume you're kind of isolated there in Sri Lanka on a nice beach island without too much coronavirus.
Yeah, it's funny that you just asked me right before we got on the call if I was here on purpose still, if I got stuck here. And I was thinking this would be the best place in the world to get stuck. It's a tiny little beach town with very, very few people, very few travelers. I'm right by the ocean. I'm just surfing every day, getting fresh air, fresh fruit. And there's no panic here. Like, you know, nobody's watching the TV and watching the news and stocking my toilet paper. I went to the grocery store yesterday. Full shelves, because nobody even uses toilet paper here. Everyone just uses the bum gun.
That's how it should be. I think this overstocking of toilet paper is the most ridiculous part of this coronavirus. I'm like, of all the things you're going to overstock with, why toilet paper? I mean, is it really that essential to survival? I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of just shows what people are fearful and people fall for FOMO. Yeah. And, you know, this is the same when, you know, Bitcoin started shooting up to 18,000. Everyone was like, well, you know, everyone else is jumping on this bandwagon. I don't want to be the only one to miss out. And I think with toilet paper, my guess is somebody saw someone else buy a ton of toilet paper, assumed, you know, that was a good idea for whatever reason. Or more likely, they're afraid that if, you know, everyone else bought it up, that they wouldn't have any. So they started buying a lot. And then someone else took a picture. And not realizing that that first person was actually buying it because they own a motel or something, or maybe they own a restaurant.
Right.
And that fear spread.
So true.
Yeah, and it probably started in the U.S. and then the photo spread to Australia, and Australia started running out of toilet paper, and that started spreading to other countries. So the fear of it has spread way faster than the actual virus.
There's a YouTube video out there of two relatively large Australian women in a Publix grocery, or not a Publix, but a grocery store, fighting over toilet paper because one lady's got her cart completely full and the other lady's asking if she can just have one of the packages. And she said no, and they got in a fist fight over it.
You know, I saw a very similar video, but sadly, it wasn't two large, you know, same age women. It was one large woman and an elderly grandma that was just like, can I please just have one pack?
Oh, and so sad.
The lady, she had so much and she just would not give her one pack. I mean, this is kind of just, this shows why socialism doesn't work, number one. This also shows how people really are in a time of panic.
Yeah, but I will say in China, I think they're actually set up better than the Western democracies to contain this, because they can basically just say, hey, if you leave Wuhan, we'll kill you. And that's what they're doing in North Korea as well. But in the Western democracies, they can just kind of suggest it and they can put in some type of mandates, but they can't really force it on you like that. So we'll see what happens in the Western countries right now. I'm glad to be out of Barcelona. I'll tell you what, Johnny, I was there about a week ago. It seemed like every person in Europe was sick. I mean, I don't know, it's coronavirus. I don't know if it's just a common cold or the flu, but everybody was hacking, coughing, runny nose, blowing their nose. And I just have to believe that the amount of people that have coronavirus compared to what the stats say, it's got to be tenfold, because a lot of people out there just think they have a common cold or maybe a light flu and they're not going to get checked because they don't want to be at a hospital with other sick people or they don't want to pay. And so they just stay home. But I think this is much more widespread than even the headline show.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. And I think a lot of countries are purposely not testing or not making it seem like a big deal because they know the negative economic impacts on their country, especially tourism, but also domestically as well. So there's an incentive for a lot of countries just not to test.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's it's crazy, right? Market's down 1,700 points again today. So what we're going to do, guys, we're actually going to have our monthly call for Patreons this month. We're going to dedicate it to coronavirus, and we're going to record that call for anyone that can't attend, and we're going to post it in the Patreon group. So stay tuned to that. We'll make an announcement of when that's coming up. We'll try to get it done in the next week. Interesting times, but Johnny, I think we should dive into another interesting topic, which is going to be this week's episode.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited for that. And for those who haven't signed up as a Patreon yet, it's the way that you guys can support the show, keep it going. We are in the process. I think we just hired our first VA. We'll make sure we introduce him in the Boss Lounge in the next couple of weeks. But thanks to you guys, we're able to continue making all these great episodes and be able to schedule these guests and kind of just do all the legwork behind it. So if you guys want to support the show, go to investlikeaboss.com, click on Patreon, and for whatever your monthly donation is, you can have access to our private group where there's a ton of benefits, like having a Q&A call every month or two with Sam and I, where we talk about what's actually happening right now. We talk about what we've bought and sold before our quarterly updates go up. So lots of cool stuff. Just check it out, investlikeaboss.com, and click on Patreon.
I love it. Thanks, guys. And so this week we're going to have on Nicholas Shackson, and he wrote a book. He's wrote many books, but he wrote a new book that's called The Financial Curse, subtitle How Global Finance is Making Us All Poorer. I just got through reading it, and Johnny, I got to say, I've read a lot of books in the last 3-4 years. This is one of my favorites. It reminds me a bit of the book that's in our recommended reading on Invest Like a Boss called The Creature of Jekyll's Island. But this book is going to talk about tax havens, monopolies, the cutthroat strategies of private equity companies and wealth managers, these people that put all these crazy complex systems in place for the super wealthy. It's almost a tack onto the family office episode that we had a few months back as well.
Yeah, and this will be the first time we'll be talking about private equity as well. It's something a lot of people are interested in.
Ooh.
And if you guys haven't checked out the book yet, you got to take a look at the cover. It is amazing. It's gold. It has a photo of a hardworking middle class guy on his hands and knees picking up pennies, picking up coins, trying to save, while there's the Monopoly man standing on his back, stealing money out of his pocket.
Woo.
And that is really the theme of this book and this episode. So without further ado, let's have on Nicholas Shackson.
Welcome back, Nick. It's great to have you on the show.
Great to talk to you.
Oh, first off, massively entertaining book, knowledge packed. And we're definitely going to put this on our recommended reading list. It took me about 6 weeks to get through. I was really digesting it in kind of 5 to 10 page chunks, but I could easily have read a book 3 times as long of the same subject matter. So great job putting it together. It's obviously been a lifetime of knowledge and research that's gone into this, but how long did it actually take you to put the whole book together?
Well, the actual writing phase, I guess, took a couple of years. I mean, I was doing bits and pieces, but that was the main thing I was doing. But the ideas behind the book are much older than that. I mean, I've been thinking about them and talking about them for, I guess, for the last 10 years or so, maybe 8 to 10 years. Just these, the concept of the finance curse sort of first began to emerge around then. And I've been just sort of thinking about it and looking at what's happening in the world and sort of, putting it all together.
What originally turned you on to the subjects? You're British. I believe you have a background in journalism, but this is really complex stuff. I find it extremely entertaining and intriguing on a lot of different levels. But what initially made you want to start cracking into writing about this stuff?
Well, it's a really good, I mean, you can go back a long way to back in the early 90s. I was the Reuters and Financial Times correspondent in Angola, in West Africa, an oil rich country. And that was a country that was in the middle of a civil war. And, people kept asking me, why is this country so poor? And all these sort of riches coming out of the ground and there's absolute astonishing destitution all around. And, one of the answers was obviously a civil war was going on. But a deeper answer, just then some academics were starting to put together a thing that they began calling the resource curse. And the resource curse is a phenomenon that strikes a lot of mineral rich countries like Angola or Venezuela or Nigeria. And there's kind of two versions of the resource curse. One is the weak version where, you know, all this money coming into these countries doesn't seem to be helping development. Maybe, you know, the elites are stealing it all and nothing is left over. That's kind of the weak version. But the strong version, and I'm sure that Angola was suffering the strong version when I was living and working there, is that all this money coming into Angola seems to make things even worse. Even though, you know, you will get a few visible rich people getting, you know, making huge amounts of money out of all the oil wealth. At the end of the day, Angolans on balance were worse off than if they hadn't had these resources in the first place. So it's, you know, it's an actual curse. And this was something that, you know, it's a kind of, they called it the paradox of poverty from plenty. And so I wrote a book back in 2010 called Poisoned Wells, which was about oil and politics in West Africa. And I found basically versions of this in a whole load of countries going up the West African coastline where there's a lot of oil being produced. And while I was writing this stuff and in the Financial Times and, you know, other newspapers, there was a guy called John Christensen in the British tax haven of Jersey. It's a little island between Britain and France. And a lot of offshore finance going on there. He was the economic advisor to Jersey. His job was to try and get the local population, you get local development and, you know, improve prosperity for local people in this tiny little tax haven of about 50,000 people. And he was reading my stuff and he was thinking, a lot of these things that I'm reading about in Angola and West Africa, a lot of these things are actually happening here in Jersey, the same stuff. And he initially decided that the tax haven business was really bad for Jersey and also bad for the world. And he kind of turned table and he set up an organization to campaign against tax havens. And he got in touch with me and he said, I'm seeing a lot of what you've been seeing in West Africa is happening here in Jersey. And just to give an couple of examples of the way you can compare Angola and, you know, this very British little island, you have a dominant finance sector in Jersey and you have a dominant oil industry in Angola. And the dominant sector will tend to suck all the best and brightest, most talented people, best educated people out of other economic sectors, out of agriculture, out of industry, out of, services and into the dominant industry. So really inflicting a whole round of damage on these industries and out of government as well. You know, you get the best educated people leaving government to join the dominant industry. And then you will have things like, in Angola's case, oil prices going up and down, you know, ranging from $10 a barrel to $150 a barrel and all the way back down causing absolute economic havoc and inflicting another whole round of damage on the economy. And similarly with finance, you know, you have the biggest example is the global financial crisis inflicting massive damage on Jersey. And he began to realize, and I agreed with him, that this wasn't just about Jersey. This was about Britain, my country, which has got a massive financial sector. And it was about the United States as well. He'd been talking about this thing called the Jersey disease, this offshore center that was bringing in these you know, trillions of dollars in and into and through this tiny little island, didn't seem to be making the majority of the population better off. And the same thing in Britain. You did get, again, a very privileged group of people who did very well out of it. In Jersey's case, a lot of them came from elsewhere and were just temporary residents. And a large majority of people, a large number of people were actually made poorer by this. They were made poorer by the fact that house prices suddenly went through the roof and they couldn't afford rent. They had to work two or three jobs to survive. And all these other factors and industry was dying, agriculture was dying. And, you know, he realized you couldn't really do anything about it because the offshore sector, this financial sector was steamrolling these other economic sectors. And so he was calling this the Jersey disease. But we began discussing this about 9 or 10 years ago. And we agreed to call it. We agreed to start thinking about it instead, going back to the idea of the resource curse, to call it the finance curse. Now, the finance curse is not an anti-finance concept. What it is really two things. One part of the concept is that too much finance can make your country poorer. In other words, we all need finance. We need it to you know, get our business loans. We need it for our ATMs and all the useful stuff. So there's this useful part of the financial sector. But once finance grows beyond its useful roles, it starts to turn harmful. And if you and there's a lot of research coming out about this now from the IMF and various other bodies, the International Monetary Fund, and all sorts of academics, producing a lot of sort of upturned U-shaped graphs. You basically, you know, as finance grows in the economy, if you don't have enough finance, the more finance grows, it benefits your economy, it supports growth, and it's good for economic growth. But you finally reach a sort of optimal point where finance is big enough, it's doing the things it's supposed to be doing. And beyond that point, if finance keeps growing, then the graph starts to turn downwards. You start to seeing more finance, meaning less economic growth, lower economic growth. And, you know, there's various ways to measure the size of the financial sector, but some of the main studies, it appears that both Britain and the United States passed the point of optimal finance sometime in the 1980s. And the financial sectors just kept growing. And this has been tremendously damaging to not just to, you know, inequality and democracy and things like that, but also it has shrunk the pie. It has made the US and the British economies smaller than they would have been if the financial sector had been back at its optimal size. So it's this kind of paradox. Too much finance makes you poorer. And that's kind of the heart of the finance curse concept.
And Nick, you use the term financialization quite a bit throughout the book, and that really is kind of just what you said. It's the growth of finance and all these new kind of financial innovations and new products that are entering the system, effectively making finance out of everything. Where, say, in manufacturing, it didn't have that much of a place before. Now, it's kind of the core part of a lot of manufacturing. Is there kind of a two-sentence or quick way that you describe financialization for the listeners?
So financialization is really two things. One is the massive growth of the financial sector in many countries, especially since the 1980s, with, you know, deregulation and tax cuts and things like that. They've really expanded the financial sector. But the other thing is the penetration of the financial sector and financial players and tools and techniques into other parts of the economy, from manufacturing to tourism to agriculture to electronics, whatever you name it. Finance has increasingly gotten in there, and the purpose principally has been to extract value from shareholders. And so I want to set up a contrast between wealth creation, the genuine productivity and people on the ground doing things and making better products and services at better prices, and contrast that to wealth extraction, where financial players are going in and, for example, buying up perfectly well-managed, perfectly well-run companies, making profits, and then kind of financially engineering them in order to extract more wealth from those companies for the benefit of the shareholders, of the people who are the owners, the new owners of those companies. And that wealth extraction is kind of the main reason why the finance curse happens, why too much finance makes you poorer, because it is a move from an economy which we had, you know, in particularly in the quarter century after the Second World War, and progressively as finance grew beyond its useful roles, it moved away from a very productive wealth creating economy towards a lot more wealth extraction. And that's what's been happening really since the 1980s. And that's one of the reasons, not just for many of the economic malaises that are afflicting our countries, but also many of the political problems, because this extraction has profound effects on, you know, democracy and inequality and people's sense of fairness. So it's a really dangerous phenomenon.
And through this financialization, it's creating a somewhat of a imbalanced world, I guess is a light way to say it. And in your book, you talk a lot about monopolies. And I thought this was really interesting, because in the book, you're talking about how, you know, through private equity and the growth of all these companies, and I guess maybe the lax of antitrust laws, you know, monopolies are becoming much more of a thing now. And when I came home just from this kind of weekend trip, I came back and my favorite local grocery store was knocked out of business. And guess what's going in? Whole Foods, owned by Amazon. And I was like, wow, I'm like reading this book and it's happening right across the street from me. And then it makes you really, as you're driving around town, you start looking at these things and all starts really kind of underscoring the narrative of the book. But in your history of studying monopolies and looking at this stuff, you know, where have you seen things go over the last 30 years to where we're at today?
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about monopolies, that's a kind of very it's a particular term. I mean, we really need to talk about market power, because often it's, you know, not just one firm, it may be, you know, three or four firms. And it's not just about consumer prices. So you back in the big days of antitrust, government was very interventionist in markets. It fought very hard to keep markets fair. And if it started to see concentrations of market power and firms being able to leverage that market power to sort of grow bigger and kill competitors on a factor that generally wasn't to do with being, you know, producing better goods or services, then it would intervene. And there were all sorts of laws and rules. Antitrust laws used to be very focused on power and market power and economic power. And in the 1970s, you had a series of scholars coming out of the Chicago School and elsewhere, Robert Bork and others, saying, well, we should stop worrying about power. We should stop worrying about corporations getting too big. And we should start focusing just on consumer prices. You know, if this is producing lower consumer prices, then everything's fine, and we should just let these mergers happen. And so that sort of way of thinking crept up on the world and crept up on the United States. And you know, consumer prices became the obsession for antitrust regulators, and they became more and more lax. And you started seeing massive growth in mergers all over the place, just companies getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I was, you know, one of my chapters is about farming, and there's been massive consolidation in U.S. farming, which has, you know, crushed lots and lots of small farmers and contributed to the enormous sense of anger that you feel in the Midwest and other parts of the states. And so you've had this enormous growth of monopolies, which has allowed companies to amass all sorts of concentrated power that allows them to kill their competitors and extract money, not just from consumers, but from workers, from suppliers. Once they have power, they can get these kind of choke points that enables them just to milk them. And again, this is unproductive stuff. You know, monopolization, you know, a big company, maybe it has economies of scale and there's some efficiencies there. But usually, due to the fact that they have market power, if they do get economies of scale and get, more wealth out of that benefit, then they just take that wealth for themselves. And it doesn't tend to trickle out to the wider economy. So you've had, this kind of very unproductive trend happening since the 1980s as companies have got bigger. And, you know, this focus on consumer prices has led us to a situation where we say, hey, look, Google services are free. Facebook services are free. What could possibly go wrong? Everything's brilliant. But I think we know that the fact that Google has got such a massively dominant position in search is, you know, it's killing newspapers all over the United States or around the world, for example, because it can cannibalize their tax revenues. Facebook similarly. I mean, we've had all sorts of scandals with Facebook taking our data. You know, on the face of it, their services are free, but at the end of the day, it's inflicting all sorts of damage all over the place. Walmart and Whole Foods and all these giants pushing out, killing smaller stores. And all of this is amassing wealth in very often in the coastal or in the money centers, these so-called coastal elites, which aren't always so coastal, and taking, you know, extracting money from other parts of the country and creating great anger. So this is one of the great dangerous trends that's been happening, particularly in the United States. You know, it's a very important factor in, you know, why U.S. healthcare is so expensive. But it's also happening in Britain and Europe, all over the world.
And Nick, I want to talk about tax havens for a second. I think everyone is familiar with this term, but most people, when they hear it, they immediately think of dirty money, drug money, Pablo Escobar. It's kind of a small niche group of corrupt elites or dodgy characters that are using these offshore systems. But I mean, from my reading in the book and education over the last couple of years, it's much more mainstream than that. I feel like, yeah. Anyways, but could you give a couple kind of headline examples of, you know, household names that are using tax havens to, you know, beat the tax system?
Yeah. So actually, my previous book was about tax havens called Treasure Islands. And this, the finance curse, is really a progression from that. So a tax haven for me is a financial sector, a country with a financial sector that transmits harm outwards to other countries or to other states. So, you know, a country might put in place a secrecy law, for example, and then, you know, billionaires from somewhere else will put their money there or put their financial affairs there. And they'll be able to hide from their own tax authorities or hide from their criminal authorities if they're, you know, organized criminals or whatever. And that causes harm to the country where the billionaire lives. And so tax havens are to transmit harm outwards. The finance curse is the other side of that. It's the financial sector in that country transmits harm inwards to the host country. So that's kind of, for me, it was a sort of logical progression. Now, tax havens cause, you know, they're kind of a misnomer. They're not just about tax. They're about all sorts of things. They're about secrecy. They're about financial regulation. That's a big factor that I describe in the book, is how the United Kingdom and its network of satellite tax havens, like the Cayman Islands, the Bermuda, and various offshore territories, allowed Wall Street players in the US financial regulations back in the 1970s, and they realized they could come to London and escape these regulations. They were kind of going offshore elsewhere. And so for me, London was kind of like an offshore center for financial regulation, which puts it in the tax haven category. So this is it's an enormous phenomenon that's been growing very fast. And if you look at that, you know, there are some indexes out there of sort of the world's biggest tax havens, and no one will be surprised that the Cayman Islands is top of the latest one. It's called the Financial Secrecy Index, which focuses on secrecy. But the second biggest tax haven on this index is the United States. And that's because foreigners can stash their financial assets in the US in various ways, and they can hide them. They use US laws, and the United States isn't going to share much information with that country's host tax authorities or criminal authorities. You know, you send your money to the US and you will, you can hide your money. And it's a combination of federal level laws, but also individual state laws. So, for example, in Delaware, you can set up shell companies that are basically impossible to penetrate. You know, you own an apartment building or a racehorse or a painting or whatever, and you set up a shell company in Delaware for a couple of $100, and nobody's going to be able to find out who owns that shell company. And that shell company will then own, you know, bank accounts and those assets, and it'll effectively cast a veil of secrecy over those assets. So lots of money is going to the United States because of this secrecy. And one of the, you know, key messages of the finance curse is, not only is this harming the countries from where this money is coming, it's also harming the United States by, and for all these reasons that I go through in the finance curse.
Well, Nick, I know we're skipping around a bit, but I really enjoyed the chapters on private equity and hedge funds. I learned a lot about strategies that they employ and just some of the actual examples about the consolidation in newspaper industry. And I think there was the one example of the Greek telecom company that was bought up and basically stripped out and cash flowed. Some of the tactics they employ are obviously ruthless, but also very interesting from a business standpoint. And I guess, you know, this being an investment podcast, something that we haven't really talked about before is private equity and hedge funds specifically, although we need to cover it. But you make the case in the book that historically you'd be much better just investing in the S&P 500, because the way that these funds are structured is really just to benefit the management first and kind of shareholders or limited partners second. Would you ever put your money with private equity or hedge funds? Or is that something that you just think is kind of a losing battle?
So I never would invest my own funds in private equity or hedge funds. And for reasons that go back to the finance curse. So these firms, private equity firms, for example, tend to be very predatory. They will, again, as I mentioned earlier, they'll go to they'll find a company in the economy that's doing very well, generating lots of cash flow, and they'll buy it up, and they will financially engineer it to extract more money from it. And there's various ways that they will do that. They may say, oh, look, this company hasn't run its financial affairs through tax havens enough. Let's do some tax haven financial engineering. So they do that, and some more profits are thrown out. And that's extraction of wealth from taxpayers. You know, people are going to have to you know, pick up the tab for that. Then they might say, you know, workers are being paid too much, or we've got too many workers and let's cut their wages, or, you know, make sure they don't join any unions, that kind of thing. So out of that comes another pot of money. And of course, that's at the expense of a second stakeholder group, the workers. Then they might say to the suppliers, look, we're paying them too early and we're being too lenient on the conditions. And so they might, you know, extract more wealth from the suppliers. They might say, look, this company's in a kind of market niche. Let's find all the other competitors in that market niche and buy them all up and build a giant monopoly. And then we can extract wealth from consumers. So you can see it's a kind of model that will tend to extract wealth from all sorts of different stakeholders for the benefit of the private equity company, the owners, you know, the titans, the moguls, whatever you want to call them. And it will also tend to get the underlying company that's bought to borrow a lot of money. And they will, the underlying company, let's say it's a company making widgets, will then borrow a lot of money. And note that it's the underlying company, not the private equity firm, that is borrowing the money. Then that company will pay the proceeds of that borrowings up to the private equity owners as a special dividend. And even more money is coming through. And so you'd think that private equity is an extremely profitable business. And it actually is very profitable. But the problem is that they make very high internal returns. So all this predation does generate a lot of cash for the private equity firms. But that the internal returns are very different from the external returns, because one of the other big games of private equity is that they will want to put in, the owners, the titans, will want to put in as little of their own money into the pot, into the investment pot as possible. They want as little of their own skin in the game. They want the outside investors, and that might be your pension fund. It could be any outside investor. They want the outside investors to put their money into that pot, and then they can take fees and so on from that pot when they invest. And so the outside investors are also getting done over, because they promise, you know, they say, look at our huge internal returns, invest with us, you're going to make a lot of money. But in general terms, and, you know, there are private equity firms, obviously, that do, you know, very well for their outside investors. But that masks the overall picture, which is that in general, private equity returns to outside investors, those people who are investing, putting their money in with private equity, are not seeing those fabulous internal returns because of all sorts of fees and other mechanisms that prevent them getting it. And if you look at the studies that are in truly independent studies that aren't somehow funded or influenced by the private equity industry, you will see that their returns, you know, when compared to similar companies, are producing nothing. The returns are no different from, you know, if you just invested in the S&P. It's similar kind of returns. And there's also a big kind of liquidity premium, because you often with private equity have to tie your money up for a long period of time. Whereas if you've just got a portfolio of equities, you can get it out at any time. So private equity is a very problematic, not just for the wider economy, but also there's a huge amount of hype about the sector and a lot of belief among people that they're going to get rich if they invest with private equity. But it turns out that all of those excess returns that they do extract, generally, they find ways not to pass those returns on to the outside investors. So I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. And particularly now, I think now is particularly, you know, has recently, asset prices, you know, ignoring the latest market turmoil, but asset prices have historically been very, very high. So private equity firms have been buying up companies across the economy at very high values, high asset prices. And, you know, even if in the past they were making high internal returns, it's much harder now because of the high asset values, combined with the fact that they tend to be much more leveraged than other investments. They tend to borrow heavily. So there's a lot of risk in there. So it just seems to me, you know, a lot of people are dazzled by the riches that you see from, you know, the owners of KKR and all these amazing private equity firms. But they don't, once they look at the small print and realize what's actually going, they realize they're not, you know, it's a much more pedestrian, lackluster, and even dangerous investment sector, in my view.
Yeah, I feel like it's, you mentioned the word dazzled, and I would see this as something that's just, it's almost like an exclusive club. It's something you invest in just to be part of it, something that's kind of fun, it's flashy. I'm invested in this hedge fund. I'm invested in this venture capital fund. I'm invested in this private equity fund. And you start getting invited to the you know, the drinks after hours and stuff. It's almost, I feel like it has that appeal. Once you've checked the box, I got my annuities, I got my CDs, I got my boring S&P 500 index. Now I want to take a splash in private equity. I'm sure that has some type of factor involved in it.
Yeah, funny. I mean, when I was speaking to people in this space, you know, everybody I asked about this said that was a factor. It's, you know, a lot of, you know, pension fund managers, they don't want to invest in, you know, treasury bills. It's just so boring. They want to be at the table with the big boys. And so many of them invest in private equity, put the money into private equity because they want to be cool. They want to kind of, you know, look, I'm in private equity. And exactly what you're saying, you know, they want to be part of this sort of gusher of money. And, you know, the problem with, you know, a pension fund manager, for example, they're not investing their own money. They're investing other people's money. And so does it matter to, you know, they get to invest other people's money and they get to hang out with these flashy people and they feel great and go to parties and stuff. And the, you know, the people with the actual pensions are at the end of the day the ones who really ought to be able to take those decisions. But you know, so it's a terrible factor of bamboozlement, and I think a lot of people, you know, it's a broader problem with the financial sector. You see all this money on Wall Street and you think, well, the more money in Wall Street, it must be good for the US economy. But the finance curse shows us that, you know, kind of the opposite is true. The more money being made on Wall Street, to a very large degree, it's a sign of economic sickness rather than economic health.
Support for today's episode comes from Automation Finance. The key to building wealth is to start early and compound returns over time. Automation Finance offers real estate-backed investments for anybody with investments starting around $250. The company's fourth fund, Reperformance Fund 4, offers up to 8% annual returns to investors, pays interest monthly, and offers best efforts liquidity. The three prior funds returned 21.5%, though past performance is no guide for future performance. Even though it's been 10 years since the global financial crisis, more than 2 million homeowners remain deeply delinquent on their mortgage payments. Many face foreclosure. Automation Finance buys these deeply distressed mortgages at a discount and works with the borrowers to avoid the loss of their homes. Once the loan is restructured, AF can hold and collect payments or resell them for a profit. Since launching in 2015, Automation Finance has resolved over 2,000 distressed mortgage loans with a par value of $200 million, saving more than 2,000 people from foreclosure and generated tens of millions of dollars in value for its investors. Now every investor can join the revolution. To start building wealth for your future and earn up to 8% returns through monthly dividends, visit automationfinance.com/boss to review the investment memorandum and sign up for an account. Remember, there are no safe investments. Even the purchasing power of cash is eroded over time. Please review the offering circular in detail before investing.
Nick, I got a few rapid-fire questions for you. You up for those?
Yep.
All right. Okay, first one. Which country has a more powerful banking system, the UK or the USA?
Well, on various measures, the UK and the US have... The US economy is much more rooted in real stuff. And the UK financial sector is much more rooted in international business, in international financial flows and cross-border stuff. And that is very substantially the legacy of the British Empire, where the City of London, as we call it, the financial sector in the UK, was the engine of the British Empire. You know, money was coming in and out of London to, you know, all the colonies around the world. And so, you know, Britain has this internationally focused financial sector, but it also means that, the U.S. Wall Street is actually diluted in a much bigger, stronger democracy. And, you know, for all the faults and all the problems that are going on at the moment, you know, we are in an even deeper state of capture by the financial sector than you know, Americans are. I think, you know, many Americans worry that Wall Street is too powerful. But we in the U.K., you know, have got a similarly sized financial sector, but... diluted in a much smaller democracy. And so we really are, I think, even more under the influence than you are.
Yeah, I was walking through London with a gentleman that runs a family office there. And he was just pointing out these, you know, crappy 2-2 apartments. He's like, yep, that's £2 million. Yep, that's £2 million. And I'm like, where does all the money come from? He's like, it's all dirty money. It's all laundered money. Oil, drugs, racketeering. And I'm like, really? Like, I always thought of London as this kind of proper by the books place. But and also I recently heard this about Dubai, that Dubai, everyone thinks Dubai was built on oil money, but some people that are on the inside there say it's no, it's all laundered money.
It's all washing money. I mean, you're absolutely right about both those places. I mean, the UK, and I think, you know, a lot of Americans, you know, when they think of Britain, they think of the Queen and Meghan Markle, and, you know, all this fun stuff and people talking in funny accents like me. But, you know, really the what's been going, Britain has been at the center of this, you know, it's attracting dirty money from all over the world and using all sorts of mechanisms, including this array of satellite tax havens around it as kind of laundering mechanisms, to bring money in from the rest of the world. And you're seeing house prices going through the roof and, you know, large parts of the population can't afford to live properly, or they're spending, you know, more than half their income on rental. And so, again, you know, all this money coming in seems to be making a few people rich, but actually the large majority of the population has been damaged by this stuff. And on the subject of Dubai, yeah, I agree. Dubai is, you know, I've been speaking to people about Dubai for many years. And for me, it is, of the big tax havens that are out there, it is the muckiest, the sleaziest. It is where, you know, organized crime, they just don't care. Anything goes in Dubai. It's just a kind of libertarian paradise for dirty money. And so I think it's good, you know, it's good that you flagged that up, because, you know, Dubai really is a, you know, a den of vice.
All right. Next rapid fire question. We'll limit this to Western democracies instead of the whole world. But who are the most powerful people in the world? Would you say it's bankers, politicians, lawyers, maybe military generals? How would you rank them?
Well, I think, you know, when I spoke about the quarter century of real prosperity after the Second World War, I think we could have very safely said it's politicians, it's governments that are, you know, keeping markets fair and, you know, keeping a lid on things. I think now you could probably make a pretty good case for saying it's financiers. You know, finance has acquired such a grip on such large parts of our economy and our political systems that, you know, I would argue personally, it's maybe a matter of taste, but I would argue that the financial sector is top dog now.
Wow. Good stuff. All right. Last rapid fire question. In your book, I found myself having to Google so many of the people that you wrote about's names just because they seem like such interesting characters. My favorite one was the guy that was living in Switzerland. He ended up living in one of Napoleon's old villas that I guess Napoleon built back in the day, and was just surrounded by exotic animals and models, and I guess just running a bunch of dodgy offshore enterprises for financiers and other people. But who is your favorite person to kind of research and learn about, what, no matter their character, just find them particularly interesting?
Yeah, you're talking about Bernie Kornfeld. He was a really interesting character. I think for me, can I talk about a bank instead of a person?
There was this absolutely
bank called Bank of Credit and Commerce International. And that was a bank that was set up. It really got going in the 1980s. And it was set up with its headquarters in London, but also main holding companies in Luxembourg, which is a European tax haven, and the Cayman Islands. And so it's kind of regulation was split between these three places, and effectively regulation happened nowhere. And this bank would do anything for anyone at any time: terrorist money, drugs money, heroin lords, you know, Afghan drugs. It was, you know, cocaine from Latin America. It would do anything. And it was exceptionally close to power in the United Kingdom. And in fact, Margaret Thatcher, the British Prime Minister, was particularly favorable to this bank, BCCI, and there had even been a plan floated to make her president of the bank after she stepped down. Nothing came of that in the end. But this bank eventually was brought down by Robert Morgenthau, the U.S. New York Attorney General, and Jack Blum and John Moscow and a few other people who tried to, you know, they started finding out just how dodgy this bank was, how many bad businesses it was involved in, and the sort of national security risks that were spilling out of this bank. And it was when they started trying to take it down in the US, they came up against a wall of opposition from the CIA, from all sorts of characters in the political system. And they just through dogged determination, they eventually made enough of a stink. And this bank was brought down, I think, in 1991 or 92. And the ramifications were enormous of just, you know, once it got out how bad this was, everyone was absolutely shocked. But the British, you know, this again points to the sort of dirtiness of what's going on in the City of London, the British financial sector. The British authorities knew what was going on. They knew how bad this bank was, but they took the attitude of, we like the money and we're going to let this carry on very quietly. And, you know, we'll get rich, meaning we, a few privileged people in the UK will get rich. And we don't care if this hurts other countries around the world. So I think BCCI for me was, you know, the most, you know, in my book, and God, there's a lot of competition, but it's the dirtiest, rottenest bank in world history. Wow. BCCI.
Greed at its finest. Yeah, will do. I will, absolutely, after this episode. But Nick, just a couple questions in closing. I mean, this is obviously a topic that you've been studying for a lifetime. You're passionate about. You know, what's your position on it going forward? Do you want to profit from it? Do you want to level the playing field? I mean, I'm sure over the course of time, you've gotten a bit of pushback by writing about tax havens, trust, you know, where billionaires keep their money. They don't want necessarily all those secrets exposed or brought to the surface. But, you know, what's your position? What do you want to try to get out of this, you know, over the next couple of decades?
You mean personally?
Yeah. What drives your passion, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, I'm you know, for me, this is a question of justice and so on. I mean, from a personal perspective, you know, I got a few savings, you know, not massive. But I, you know, I just, you know, invest them in ETFs and stuff. You know, even those are problematic. There's all sorts of issues you need to be careful of. And you're investing in a lot of financialized corporations. But, you know, with bank deposits paying nothing, you know, what do you put your money in? So from a personal perspective, you know, I'm not looking to profit from this stuff. And I really want to, this book is driven by a passion. I'm, you know, as was my previous book about tax havens, you know, I'm a strong believer that tax havens have been a very, very negative and very large problem for the world economy. And similarly, finance being out of control, being too big, is something that I would like to change. I would like to have an influence on waking people up to the fact that we need to do something about this, that we need to shrink finance back to its useful core. We need to get finance working for people again, rather than people working for finance, you know, the country working for finance. And that's my aim and objective. And that's what I'm going to be continuing to do and trying various different ways. I mean, a book is one way, but writing articles and, you know, talking to people and investigating to try and get, you know, get something done about this, because I think it poses great dangers for our economies and our democracies.
Nick, is the financial curse currently available? Has it been published already?
Yes, the finance curse came out late last year, and it's in any good bookstore. Try not to encourage people to buy it on Amazon, because that's part of the problem.
You know, I really enjoyed reading it because it's timely and relevant, whereas a lot of books you read, they've been published 10, 15, 20 years ago. Everything in this seemed like it was current. So I felt like I was reading almost the news headlines in a sense. But fantastic book. And, you know, what's coming up next for you? Do you have any new projects or new books that you're working on?
Well, actually, I'm in the early stages of making a documentary film about the finance curse. And the analysis, you know, the talking heads is fairly easy. We've probably already got that nailed and without too much trouble. What we want to do is to get real human characters, real people in the film, and to tell, you know, a couple of stories to engage audiences. That's the stuff that's difficult. That's going to take, you know, the next couple of years, I think. But I hopefully a finance curse film will be coming to your screens before too long.
That would be brilliant. I would really enjoy that. Well, we look forward to it, Nick. Awesome work on the books. I'm looking forward to reading some of your previous books as well. But all the listeners, links in the show notes, check out The Financial Curse. Nick, keep up the good work. We appreciate you, and learned a lot over the last month of reading the book and speaking to you as well.
Okay, thanks. Great to talk to you.
Wow, I never, ever thought that the wealthier a country or the more resources a country has and the bigger the finance center, the more it actually ends up screwing its everyday people, its citizens.
Oh, man, I'm looking at the world a lot different now. You know, this coronavirus, they're talking about bailing out all the big airline companies, all the big travel companies. I'm just like, okay. And I'm thinking back to the book and I'm like, it's just going to go to benefit the big companies. It's going to screw the taxpayer. Our savings are going to be inflated away. And the cycle continues. All the politicians are in cahoots with all the big companies. And then you look at like Amazon, all the ridiculous tax credits that they're getting and Tesla to set up factories in these different places. It goes to benefit them and it screws the everyday taxpayer and consumer like us.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, it seems like a good idea. It seems like these companies, you know, provide jobs, provide good services, and in many cases they do. I mean, you know, all of us love ordering things off Amazon. All of us love Teslas. Yeah. But, you know, in general, these big, you know, companies, especially these finance companies, I would say they're in another league. I'm okay with companies like Apple or Amazon or Tesla, you know, not paying their fair share when it comes to taxes because they're, you know, they're delivering a good product that we want. But when it's a bank or a finance company or a private equity firm that isn't providing any actual, you know, substantial value, they're not actually creating any physical thing. They're just moving money around and just taking, you know, a couple commas off of it every time they move it. That's what really pisses me off.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I also think that this, it might just be my own experience, but it's what I see happening in the world. Where the best time to be some type of web entrepreneur was kind of 2003 to 2010. It was when it was this new frontier on the internet and most big companies had no idea what they were doing online. It was pretty easy for an average Joe to build a website and compete and be a tech company, a tech startup. Now I think it's so difficult. You have to raise so much money and be so well connected. And then you have to go out and execute. But to me, it seems like the amount of startups that are succeeding are becoming fewer and fewer. And so many are just living and dying on via Amazon and or Google. And they kind of choose who they want to be in business and who they want to take out. Google can take out anybody. You know, you see them doing /flights now. They're going to take out all the big flight aggregators and OTAs. I don't know. It's scary. I think here's what I think after reading this book and what I'm seeing in the world. And I mentioned on this episode that the little grocery store where next to me in Charlotte just closed down and Whole Foods going in. And I think there's just more and more and more of this happening. So I actually think that it's a challenging time to do some type of tech startup or to be a startup entrepreneur. But it's actually a great time to coincidentally invest in the S&P 500 because I think all those companies at the top are just going to get bigger and bigger, consolidate and swoop up more market share. And that's going to reward people that are invested.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, especially if you're investing while the markets are hammered right now and
oh God,
down. We'll be talking about that on the Patreon call on what both Sam and I are planning to do with our investments, if we're going to be, you know, selling or buying. But don't worry, for everyone else on that's listening to the normal podcast, we'll update you guys in the next quarterly update. But for the Patreons, make sure you go on the live call so you can ask questions live on the call. And for those who can't attend live, don't worry, we'll post the recording in the Patreon group as well for you to listen to. But as far as these big, you know, the big companies versus the small companies, for me, I think it's a strange thing. I just cannot wrap my head around is when is enough enough? You know, like a company like Google, you know, they started as a search engine company. They did great. And they're like, okay, maybe we should add in, you know, email. Oh, awesome. That makes sense. Now let's add in maps. Okay, that makes sense. Let's add in, you know, these things here and there. But then when is enough enough? I mean, when, like, why do companies need to continue growing, getting bigger and bigger, you know, having more money, more reach? Is it until they get hit with either an anti, you know, monopoly suit or the company ends up just, you know, folding, just getting too big?
Yeah.
Like, why can't companies just be happy? I mean, I guess why can't people just be happy?
Well, I think people is the more difficult one to answer because companies, especially in the case of a public company, they have shareholder pressure. If management's not producing and not raising revenues and profits and generating shareholder value, then they're ousted and new, hardworking, ambitious people are put at the top to continue to pay dividends to all the shareholders. But how much is enough, right? I mean, when you look at where the wealth is concentrated in the world, and I know a lot of listeners will hate this, but this is why I think that some type of high level wealth tax at the high level, I mean, how much is enough, Johnny? How much do you think is truly enough?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say because after, you know, these 100 episodes and speaking to people in your network who have really expanded my mind on, you know, what is wealth, I've realized that nobody's happy where they're at. You know, everybody wants more. And I can imagine that, you know, for someone who has nothing in the bank, they're, you know, they would say, man, if I just had 10 grand, if I had 5 grand in the bank, I'd be so set. You know, I'd be comfortable. I don't have to, you know, stress about rent. You know, and then to someone who has 50 grand, they might be like, well, you know, I really just, you know, I really want 100 grand. And then the 100 grand wants a million. The millionaire wants 3 million. The guy with 3 million wants 10 million. The guy with 10 million wants 25. And it just it's never enough. It really isn't.
It's never enough. It's never enough. But I have to believe that if everyone stepped back and just say, okay, how much is enough, right? That reasonable, rational people would say 50 million should be the most that you should be able to accumulate, right? At 50 million, you can have the jet. You can have 4 houses. You can never spend all your money as long as you're not completely trying to blow it. But after 50 million is where all the you know, that 0.01% of people sit, but they own so much of the world's wealth. And they're never going to spend it all. They're never going to recirculate it back into the economy. So I just don't see the point of being a billionaire, except for the ego boost, right? Like, you're not going to enjoy $1 billion more than you can enjoy 50 million. And that's where, I don't know, that's where I think greed kicks in and does a lot of harm to society and creates this social class warfare, because you just don't need that much money. And it just creates a greedy world, right? Because it's obvious you don't need that much money.
I'm actually very shocked this has come from you, Sam. I think the listeners,
I know,
if they didn't hear your voice, they would just assume we had switched places for a day.
But it's true. And, like, I don't know, the small retailers are really struggling. And I hate to see these people get put out of business because Whole Foods, right? I mean, Whole Foods is a great product, but I also like the mom and pops. And I love, like, the hardworking people around the world, but everyone's getting squeezed. And I even in startups, it's like, hey, I can spend 5 years working my ass off building a really awesome business, and then some Yahoo in Silicon Valley that has access to $100 million raises it off a PowerPoint presentation and eats my lunch in 2 months. And hey, that's business. That's the way the world's constructed, right? So if you want to play the game and you want to play the pure capitalism, that's the game you got to play. You got to be willing to live by the sword and die by the sword. But I don't know. I'm starting to view the world a little bit differently. And I think a lot of that is based on our lifestyle, Johnny, over the last couple of years, where we've just realized our happiness is not correlated to how much money we make. In fact, it might actually have a negative correlation. And just realizing that we can live such a great life off so little, we just got to find the right places in the world and the right community.
$871 a month. That's what I've been spending here in Sri Lanka, living at the beach, surfing every day, eating smoothie bowls, eating fresh fruit. It's been great.
It's amazing, man. It's honestly inspiring, and it's a great story and reference point, I think, for so many people out there, including myself. But I do want to read a quick excerpt of the book just to give people an idea of what it's like at the high end, because we're talking about trust in this book. We're talking about monopolies. We're talking about private equity. We're talking about tax havens. It's very complicated stuff. And who puts that together? Lawyers and wealth managers. So I'm going to read you just a quick paragraph of what it's like to be a wealth manager from this book. So here we go. To make their clients, and by the way, I got a lowest 10% on my SATs reading comprehension, so I'm really bad at reading, but I've been practicing. Right. So I'm going to try my best. To make their clients feel comfortable, the wealth managers ideally come from the same social class, having imbibed the same managers and customs from childhood. Down at the heels, aristocrats from old European money or sophisticated opera-loving smoothies for the more refined type. And for the really rich people, they must be good. They need to construct and manage large, complex international structures involving banks, tax havens, trusts, and foundations, wills, shell companies, hedge funds, shares, and bond portfolios and insurance products, while funding pet think tanks and lobbyists and plenty more, putting them right at the heart of the machinery of global finance. They must keep their clients' assets dancing freely between different legal systems, taking advantage of accounting and legal loopholes while avoiding getting snagged by the rules and responsibilities of each place. and staying permanently abreast of shifting legal and political tides in each country. They must provide savvy investment advice, navigate family fights, and organize bodyguards, pay gardeners, servants, and serve friends, shoulders to cry on, psychologists, butlers, and guardians of mistresses, misdemeanors, and family secrets. So that's what it looks like to be a wealth manager. And it kind of ties into the family office episode, right? Where we're talking about how do these centimillionaires and billionaires manage their life and all the complexities without, you know, and still be able to enjoy what they've achieved in life. And it's all done through, you know, these people that handle all the complex shit for them.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's really interesting. So one thing that came up during the interview is, would you invest in a private equity firm? Because I think even though some of the minimums are really, really high, sometimes it could be $25 million, there are some that are much less that you can buy into. Would you ever do it? Have you ever looked into it?
I've looked into hedge funds quite a bit. And I know people in the private equity business, which I like the model of private equity, but I don't know. I think it is somewhat of a hedge. I mean, a hedge fund's called a hedge fund for a reason. But I, even though we're going through this massive market pullback right now, I still feel like I trust like a Vanguard S&P index for these type of things more. I don't know. I really like my portfolio, I guess is what I'm saying. And I haven't invested in private equity or hedge funds yet. And after reading this book, it definitely doesn't give me any more desire to do so. So I would say I'm not planning on doing that for the next, for the foreseeable future.
Okay, good. I'm going to play back this episode. I'm going to call you out. rewind this episode if you ever start thinking about it. For me, I think of PE firms and, you know, basically most of Wall Street like I do a casino. When I walk into the Bellagio in Vegas and I see, you know, the gold accents, the Persian rugs, you know, like the crystal champagne, I'm thinking, wow, this costs a lot of money to build. The people here are swimming in cash. Who is paying for all this? Mm-hmm. And it's the suckers at the slot machines and at the tables who are paying for all the stuff, you know, because they're making money hand over fist. And when I see, you know, these private equity firms, you know, just, you know, spending money on private jets, on these parties, all these things, and I see their fees, I realize, you know what? They have to work so much harder to just even to break even on the expenses, on the fees, to even before they even start making me money. And I'm not going to fund that lifestyle for them. So the answer is no. And especially after hearing this interview, you know, and the experts in the book, like it, I think it's a really shady type of business.
I do too. I think it's super cutthroat. And there's a lot of examples in the book I won't spoil, but I would definitely recommend reading those. But I will say that I got to be honest, what would change the equation for me is if I was living in a city and there was some hotshot private equity or hedge fund that gave you kind of all these cool community social bonuses or benefits for being part of it. You know, you invest $100,000, $200,000, and you get to access to the clubhouse, and once a month you go out on the yacht or something. That would probably change it for me. But strictly based on returns or a hedge, nah. I think there's better ways to do it.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And then, you know, at some point the cost of membership may be worth it just for the fringe benefits. But you know, but at the same time, you know, it's the investors are the ones paying for that yacht and that club. So know where your money's going.
Yeah, absolutely. Johnny, you know the sunglass company, the big sunglass company? I think it's called like Luxottica or something.
Yeah, the one that owns Ray-Ban and so pretty much every other big brand out there.
Exactly. They own the manufacturing. They own the distribution points. They own the retail sunglass hut and all the other sunglass ones. I mean, they have a literal monopoly on any type of fashion sunglasses. And so what they did, I don't know if you heard this, but they wanted to buy Oakley and Oakley wouldn't sell. So they told Oakley that they can't be in any other retail shops or any other distribution. And they announced it and it crashed Oakley stock. And then they bought up Oakley once it had crashed.
Oh.
And so like part of the case in this book is just like, hey, it's too big. And then there's no competition and that's bad for everybody. And that's basically a monopoly and should be broken up. But I know a lot of people listening, and I think a slightly younger version of myself would say, hey, that's business. That's awesome. That's using leverage. That's smart. That's strategic. And there's two sides of it, but I do think the world is getting a lot more monopolistic right now.
Yeah, that is so, so crazy. And it's unfair. And I think that, I don't know. I mean, I don't want a big government stepping in business, but at the same time, things like that are just unfair. Luckily, with the internet now, everybody can create a sunglass brand, sell it on Amazon, and finally they have some competition. So things eventually do work itself out, and you know, people find ways to buy things. But yeah, that's an example. I mean, Oakley was one of the only brands anyone has ever heard of that Luxottica did not own. I mean, they literally owned every single other brand. You know, and the stores, as you said, LensCrafters, Sunglass Hut, you know, Pearle Vision, Sears Optical, Target Optical are all owned by Luxottica, including every single brand inside those stores. And they also make all the sunglasses for the big fashion brands like Chanel, Prada, Armani, Burberry, Versace. So they basically make everything. They make everything you've ever heard of or seen.
And how does it make you feel that how does it make you feel that the governments don't step in to break up these monopolies, but when coronavirus spreads or the Great Recession happens, the government's sitting there saying they're going to bail out all these big companies that basically are monopolies? So they win on the way up, they hold their monopoly at the top, and then if the world goes south and the economy struggles, they get bailed out. It's just, it's not right. It's not fair. Yeah.
Too big to fail.
Sorry. It's just not. Yeah. I don't like it.
I know. But at the end of the day, a lot of it is, as a consumer, we do have the power to do our own research now because, you know, the internet makes it so easy to be able to shop from mom and pop stores or even not even mom and pop stores. Like, how many of us buy exclusively from Amazon? When we could have went to websites for, you know, like, let's say you want to buy some hiking stuff, right? You can go to, I mean, North Face is a big company, but you can buy directly from North Face. You don't need to buy North Face stuff on Amazon.com. But how many of us are just lazy and we want free shipping, we want it to be easy? So we buy everything on Amazon and we never go directly to the manufacturer, and we never shop through kind of smaller stores. And that creates the monopoly even more.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah. From that standpoint, I think I'm okay with it. What really ticks me the wrong way is the bailouts. Like, if a company is going to be super aggressive, raise tons of money, run unprofitable for 10 years, get to the top, overstaff, have too much fixed cost, and then we hit a downturn and they get a get out of jail free card, I'm not cool with that. They need to be allowed to fail. American Airlines needs to be allowed to fail if coronavirus continues on. They shouldn't be bailed out. The big banks shouldn't be bailed out in 2000. Like, otherwise, the system never corrects itself, right? This coronavirus is a flush out, and companies should be flushed out. And if my company's not strong enough to get through it, we should be flushed out. That's just the way it goes, right?
Yeah, especially if companies are over-leveraged and they take these big gambles knowing that they have nothing to lose. And that's why I'm not a big fan of over-leverage. I'm not a fan of leverage in general at all. I mean, I like to own my investments in cash and not be leveraged at all. So that's something to think about, guys. While you guys are riding the stocks up and down, be very, very careful trading options, you know, betting the market's going to continue going down, especially if you're leveraging yourselves. I will leave it at that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also, this is a good book and also a very good time with the markets as chaotic as they are to make sure and start thinking about diversification. If you're feeling a lot of pain right now, it's because you're not diversified enough. There's plenty of assets that are doing fine right now in this market. So if you're feeling the pain, listen to some of our episodes on diversification and review your portfolio. It's a good time to start thinking about it and also build a better portfolio for the future.
Yeah, definitely. So it's been fun talking to you, Sam, and I look forward to talking to you in a few days on the Patreon episode, as well as having all of you who are listening come on the Q&A, you know, or take a listen to the recorded version of it. And if you enjoy this podcast, please tell your friends, because we have been on a roll with a lot of 5-star reviews, people telling their friends about it. And, you know, I think it's because people like this podcast as a trusted source of information. So big thank you for everyone who's left reviews. This week, I want to give a shout out to Beach7H. He says, look forward to every podcast, 5 stars. I made it. Okay, I made and lost and made a lot of dough. So this point of my life, I'm pretty much Mr. Conservative. A balanced 50-50 stock bond portfolio and a paid for real estates. But I started listening to this podcast to challenge my assumptions, to hear and learn new things. I thought that today's podcast about second passports was especially interesting. Then I took a look at the speaker's website and found out that it's the best source of info I've seen about opening foreign bank accounts. Well said, Jeff H. from LA. I'm really glad you enjoy the podcast and you enjoyed the latest episode. Please leave a review of the show for this episode or just in general.
Yeah, absolutely. And guys, stay tuned until next week. Big name guest. I'm not going to name him yet because he has a tendency to be a bit flaky. So I want to make sure we get him on and record it before we announce it. But fingers crossed it goes through. It'll be a great episode next week as well.
Yeah, but another bonus, if you're in the Patreon, there is a thread in there with his name and a way for you to be able to ask him questions. So go to investlikeaboss.com, click on Patreon, help us support the show, and we'll see all of you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.